come to shul, and then they would come for mincha on Shabbos afternoon for the afternoon prayer. And traditionally, after mincha, you have the Seder Shlishis, the third meal, in the synagogue. We have it in our shul all the time. Yeah, I have some filter fish, some herring, you know, make a motzi, and you sing some songs, and you bench. That's your meal. Well, these people were hungry, generally. And they didn't have enough to keep the sustain, because most of them were refugees. They were living on the dole, so to speak. None of them had jobs. Some of them had jobs. I was able to get a few of them jobs, as a matter of fact. But they came to shul Shabbos afternoon. And this kichelmacher he would bring some challah or something, and that would be the meal. Yeah. This kichelmacher, you remember Herman's Bakery here?
Sure. Right. Sure.
Joe Herman's, who owned that bakery, Shalom, had a brother who lived in Rome. His brother came here to visit, and I talked to him. He's I remember him. Sure, I remember him.
Oh,
funny thing. Anyway, so Kichelmacher says to me, we have to buy some stuff. And this fellow Bernstein, this Bernie, this mail clerk I was telling you about, he used to give me money. He had the gambling. I says, Bernie, I says, I just had to show him that one time. After I showed him that, I said, look, you guys are passing a lot of bucks in that gambling. I said, give a little to tzedakah. And we even made an inscription in the Jewish National Fund Golden Book from there. I have the certificate. We sent money, sent $100 at that time.
Wow.
But so I said to Bernie, I said, look, we got to get these guys got to eat. I said, well, we're eating, they should eat. So he used to give me, I always had a bundle of money. So I said to Kichelmacher, but that's kaifen time, got it. But there wasn't anything to buy. You couldn't buy much. So there was a Jewish mess sergeant in one of the units. So I went over to him. I said, look, I said, I need a case of salmon. You know, these Argo salmon cans.
Right.
I said, it's going to get lost someplace. I said, I told him what I wanted it for. So sure enough, I said, I used to get medicine from the there was always, the Jewish boys were amazing. Yeah. Jewish boys did everything they could do for anybody. Used to get like penicillin sometimes you needed. You go to one of the medics, you'd get it. See, in the Army, there's such a thing as called OS&D report, over, short, and damaged. If something is short, you sign a statement, it's short, faulty. It's got lost. You lost the inventory. So I remember I brought this case of salmon. See, I was protected that I was able to carry, because most guys would be on the black market, see? But I was in my chaplain's chair.
Yeah.
And I brought it to this fellow Kichelmacher. I said, look, this is a case of salmon. Now, you got enough here for maybe, there were 24 cans at the time. You got enough here for 10 Shabbos, for Shalosh Shabbos. Take some salmon. Let somebody put some celery or that vegetables they had. It says, and you'll make a little. Well, that case of salmon must have lasted for 8-10 weeks. And he kept it, he didn't use it himself, and he was very honest. And they had their shalashuddas, they had their third meal. It was, there's so many little tidbits that are fascinating and very interesting. We had, unfortunately, I later met some people who come to Pittsburgh who knew some of these people. People who were, I don't know whether you know or not, but Nancy and I are deeply involved in the transplant program here. And there are many observant people who come from Israel, New York, like the fellow who was here last night from Philadelphia. He stayed here. They come here for transplant, here for 3 months, 4 months at a time. And we, thank God,
Crespi's Hospital.
Yeah. We've been able to house these people, families, who stay with us for periods of time. Hansi is amazing. I mean, there's one thing that just came up a few weeks ago, oddly enough, and I'm going to tell you about it, and I'll let you go. It's late for you. We were in North Africa. There's a fellow comes to my office. I had my office. I have a picture of it. It's a table in a little room in that little hut, an old Nissen hut we had. He comes to my office, and he tells me he talks only Yiddish. He can't talk English. He was taken in the army. He was naturalized in the army. They took him. He'd come out of the camps, and they took him they sent him right overseas because he could speak German and another language. And this is my office. Look. This is my office. This is Hansi's picture. He graduated college from Boston University. This is my office.
Yep, and that's your typewriter.
That wasn't bad.
No, it was. Oh, what do you mean? That was great. Yeah. It was.
You touch type?
Yeah, I type very fast. Good. This is the Nissen hut. This was our chapel. This was where my office was.
Okay.
So, he comes in and he tells me. He says, "Is that Yiddish?" I says, "Yeah." So he's telling me in Yiddish. He was taken out. He survived the camps. Came to New York, and he was taken into the army. And he was naturalized overseas. They had a unit that would go around naturalizing boys in the army. The fellow's name was Hazard. Leland Hazard here in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was related. Uh-huh. I once told Leland Hazard about this. The guy, it was Dr. Hazard. He was the one from the army. He was deputized. Mm-hmm. He could make you a citizen. So they made him a citizen. He's in this 7th Battalion or someplace up in the field, and he says they make fun of me. Chazik from there, Kenneth Redenken Engels. He can't, and he doesn't know what to do. He says, he's weak, and they're marching. He's marching. He's marching. What is he going to do? So of course I bring out the cookies I had, and I call his sergeant. I says, and this fellow's name. He told me. I remember. He told me his name is Abe Stein. Stern. Abe Stein. Uh-huh. From Brooklyn, Stein. So I call his sergeant. I says, "You got a guy up there?" Yeah, I'm buddy with the guy. "You got a guy up there, the name is Stern." "Oh," he says, "that blankety blank blank." He says, "Hey, he's miserable. He's having so much trouble with him. He doesn't know his left from his right. He doesn't understand what we're telling him." I said, "Yeah, I know." I says, "You know, the chaplain needs somebody to clean up this place every day." I said, and he had nothing to do. He was just a replacement waiting to be assigned. I says, you need somebody to clean up this place. And could you send him down here? We could use him. He says, "Oh," he says, "great, so take him. I'll send him there every day." So he used to send him down. He used to sweep up a little bit. And he would sit and he would read and shmooze. Listen, the guy, Nebuch, he was up service. But I don't, as a kid, I don't remember where I had the guts to do some of these things. Anyway. So we're talking, and he comes back one day, he says, in the day room, you know, each battalion had a day room where they played cards, had a radio, it's all, no television. So he says, there's a sign there that says, in need of looking for a barber.
Oh.
I said, "Stern, Mr. Barber, are you a barber?" He says, "No." But when he was in the concentration camps, he had to shave the heads.
Oh.
And he knew how to use clippers, and he knew how to use a razor. So I said to him, "Stern, you're a barber." I called this guy in the 7th Battalion. I said, "You know that guy, Stern, that blankety-blank guy that you've been sending down to me?" I said, "You know, this guy's a diamond in the rough. You guys looking for a barber. This fellow's a European barber." Really? Oh, they got all excited. He says, "Send him back." Well, in the Army, everything was a GI issue. The doctors, for example, had all their surgical instruments. It was a kit that the Army would send. And for the camp barber, there was a pouch that had a razor, clippers, scissors, combs, everything you need for a barbershop. In a OD pouch that you rolled up and could carry from camp to camp. Army had everything. So they gave him a tent and a chair. And this barber kit, And he sat there all day long. How many guys would, everybody wanted to go into town to get barber, to get your hair cut, a French barber with that schmegatz that they throw on your head, you know. So he didn't have it. What was the barber? You put a bowl on you. In the army, didn't make any difference. So he was, and he used to, they would pay 10 francs to get a haircut, equivalent of about 15 cents. So, and he made money. Oh, I used to send money to his family in, through the Army Fiscal Office. Anyway, nobody bothered him. He was honored by his whole crew. Life. I tell this last 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, there was a boy in the, 35-year-old man in Presby from New York, whose name was Lang, Eugene Lang. His father and his brother brought him here. He had ileitis, and they think that that new drug that Starzl has been working with, FK, which is used for liver transplants to avoid the rejection, they think that FK can help ileitis. Mm. So they sent him here to the Presbyterian Hospital, and he was in the hospital, and his brother and father stayed with us. We're sitting at the table on Shabbos, and this father, who's from Hungary, old-timer, speaks with a real Hungarian accent, you know, like this, with a special sing-song. He tells me that he started to recount to me some of his army experience. He was in the American Army. He said he was naturalized just before he went into the army. So I said, I know of a case where a man was naturalized in the army overseas. And I proceed to tell him this story. He says, Bumchik.
Bumps?
He knew him. This
He's a barber in New York.
No. Oh, I didn't tell you. I met him in New York. We were visiting with some friends in Borough Park, which is a very, very, you don't play around there. If you don't have a black hat, and I don't have a black hat. But I went to the shul there on Friday night with some friends of mine. And
the Bobbitchers?
No, just Jews. and I see a guy sitting up front there, little fellow. And I said to the fellow I was with, I said, David, do you know that fellow? He said, no, I don't know him. He comes here every Friday. He comes here to shops in the shul in Borough Park. And when the shul's over, I have, thank God, have a unique ability never to forget a face. Names can escape me. This guy's walking out of shul, all dressed up, nice Shabbos thick, nice. And I walk over to him and I said, "Is your name Stern?"
Oh my.
He says, "Yes." He's about 4 feet. I mean, he's a very little guy. Mm-hmm. I said, so I put my arm around him. I said, "If I say North Africa to you, does that mean anything?" He says, Roy, he comes up to his full 4 feet. He says, yeah. He says, I was in North Africa. I said, if I say Canastel to you, does that mean anything? He looks at me. He said, he'd never seen me in civilian clothes. He didn't know who I was. So I said, I remember you. I said to him, how's the barber business? Just like that. He says, I am not the barber. I said, but you were, weren't you? He looks at me.
I thought you meant in the concentration camp.
I told him who I was. He didn't remember me. You remember my name. There was some guy there that helped me. Well, when I told him, he grabbed me, kissed me. He wouldn't let me go. I had to go visit. Because he says, you know what his business is now? He makes belt loops. In New York, everything's a business. God. He makes the loops for belts. Everything's a business. So he insisted I come to see his wife and his children, and he was so excited.
I'll bet. What a story.
I tell this story to this guy. And how did it start? He told me about being naturalized in the army.
Right.
So he says, Bumchik, sure I know him, he says. He says, this man is amazing. He spends time, he's retired now. He must be late 60s, I'm sure. He's retired now. He spends his time helping people in nursing homes. Oh. And he says he cuts his brother. He's got a brother in a nursing home. The man was sitting right in that chair. He says he's got a brother in a nursing home in New York. And Bumchik comes and cuts his hair.
Oh,
Amazing.
He says he still has that. He still has that pouch. I told him. I said about the pouch. So he still got that.
The one, the army pouch.
Can you imagine?
What a story! I think that pouch.
Now we're recording a new subject, aren't we?
This is our second session with Donald Butler, Harold Kimball, and Judy Rubenstein on May 26, 1992. During the last session, we spoke about your very interesting experiences during World War II in North Africa and then Italy. As we arrive today, you showed us a book that you just received, The Chief Rabbi, the Pope, and the Holocaust, by Robert Wise Broad and Wallace Silipoa. Would you tell us about it, please?
Well, I've become fascinated with this book because I lived through and was involved in Rome at this time. I was in Rome in late 44 and 45, assigned to Rome Area Command, the headquarters of Rome Area. That was after the Germans had left. I mean, it was under Allied military government. And one Sunday morning, I was assigned to the chaplain section. Part of my work was handling Vatican relations for the American Army. What did that mean, such a fancy title? It simply meant that when congressmen and senators and people began to come to Rome after the war, they all wanted to go to see the Pope. So they had to have somebody to make the appointments and things like that. And I was the underling. I was only a corporal. I was the underling who used to make the appointments and arrange. And I also, interestingly enough, learned a lot because I had to process the marriages of the American GIs. Unfortunately, a lot of our GIs had to marry these Italian girls, and they used to come to my office. At that time, I already had a fancy little office. Used to come to my office because I was attached to the Protestant chaplain in Rome after Jacob Hockman, who was the Jewish chaplain, left to go back to the States. And my job was to process the marriages. I learned how to post the bands in the church and all of the Catholic things that had to be done. Very fascinating experience. And one day, the Catholic chaplain, I remember his name well, George Sherry, came into my office on Sunday morning and says, "You know, Don," he says, "your chief rabbi just became a Catholic. Isn't that wonderful?" And I look at him. He's my chief rabbi? Turned out that Israel Zoli, who was then the chief rabbi of Rome, converted and became a Catholic. He took the name Eugenio, which was the name of Pius's name originally. His name was Pacelli. Pacelli was the Secretary of State at that time. Later became the Pope, and Zoli. Took the sacraments of the church, and his wife as well. And I, all were excited, and through our office immediately came cables and telegrams from all over the world. Stephen Wise at that time, "Be strong," you know, and so forth and so forth. And we transmitted this to the Italian community. The Italian community was a little shattered. But they had expected this man to do something odd because he was not—he had already been repudiated by the Jewish community. He was not being—he was not fulfilling his obligations. They wanted to open the Collegio Rabbinico, the rabbinical college, and he refused. And he felt that he was. It was not for him to teach little children and all that. He was a very strange. He had a, I guess if I were a psychiatrist or maybe a psychiatrist would have a field day with a man like that. He expressed himself once as
as a great honor for the Rome community to have him as a rabbi, but no honor to him to be their chief rabbi because they were ignorant people. He was not a kind, pleasant person. Mm-hmm. I had met him a couple of times and naturally was in awe of the chief rabbi of Rome. I mean, and I remember just a curious little anecdote that my parents always sent me food. Mom used to send me cookies, and because I didn't eat the full meals at in the army mess. I didn't eat any meat. And fortunately, when I was in Rome, I was in the hotel Albergo Oriente, which is in the Piazza Paoli. That's just behind the Fountain of Trevi. And I shared a room with a fellow who was never there. He was always out. At any rate, so I had food. And if you remember, in the olden days, there was a brand of sardines called Eagle sardines.
I was raised on it.
Yeah, I think they cost a nickel a can at that time. We always liked the small Norwegian sardines, the real small ones. The eagle sardine was a little fatter.
Right.
It wasn't the big... So Poppy used to always send me cans of sardines. I had cans of condensed soup and things like that because I had a hot... You remember in the olden days they used to make hot chocolate in the drugstore with a cup that they plugged in?
Uh-huh.
Helmko Lacy hot cup. I had one of those with me.
Wow.
I brought it along with me. And I used it to heat soup and things like that. Anyway... So I once gave Zoli some of these sardines. I used to bring him stuff from time. Any time I go to see him, listen, there you did. Any, no matter what you brought, they could use. So every once in a while, I would bring in bring him something. I only saw him about three or four times. So I brought him some Eagle Brand sardines. Well, he loved those. Mm-hmm. And curiously enough, nobody ever asked for anything. Nobody ever asked to be given something. But he used to ask me for those. If I ever got the eagle sardines, he would like to have them. Isn't that interesting? I
mean, what
did his name become?
Zolli.
No, no.
Eugenio. That was the name of the Pacelli, who later became the Pope.
So you have connections there?
Not anymore. you'll laugh when I tell you that many of the vendors... It's very difficult to tell the difference between an Italian and a Jewish Italian, and a Christian Italian and a Jewish Italian, because they've lived there for generations, and they look the swarthy, dark complexion. They all look
Mediterranean.
So it's hard to tell. But an interesting thing, if you go at that time, and I think even to this day, the last time we went, it was true too. The vendors. In Piazza Venezia, in Piazza San Pietro, St. Peter's Square, they have vendors. Anybody going in to see the Pope wants to buy a Christopher's medal or something,
to have the Pope blessed.
It was a big business. That's right.
Yeah, I know.
And the Jewish vendors had this. And then they used to walk around with like in the nightclubs with a cigarette girl has a little tray around their shoulder. Well, they would have this, and many of the Jewish boys, everybody wanted to go to the Vatican. Everybody wanted to go to see the Pope. I mean, that was a big thing. So when soldiers had their day off, and that was a rest center as well, they would go. And when you pass these fellows going into St. Peter's, they would say, St. Christopher medal, Madonna, Fatima, buy something. Yeah. If you didn't react... He would flip the card over and he'd say, Mezuzah?
Oh, yeah, they were business.
Yeah, they were business then.
Yeah.
But anyway, coming to this book,
yes.
I'm so fascinated by this that I'm like a baby with a new toy. This book corroborates a lot of the things that I've been talking about over the years. And it makes me feel good that it's true, because many times things become a little jaded. And become anecdotal. Mm-hmm. But I remember many of the names of the people who were here. For example, Greenlee, who was the head of the joint. Renzo Levy, who was the head of, this Greenlee was an American who came after the war for the Joint Distribution Committee. Mm-hmm. I just told Donnie Robinson about this the other night, because Donnie Robinson was the national president of, mm-hmm. of the Joint Distribution Committee. Anyway, and Renzo Levy, who was the head of the DLSM, that's like a federation of Italians, looked after refugees, Ottolenghi and Captain Newfield, who was Lieutenant Colonel Poletti, who was the Lieutenant Governor of New York, I think, became the Allied Military Governor in Rome, in Italy. And Poletti, his adjutant, was a fellow named Captain Neufeld. This book delineates a lot of this stuff, and I'm fascinated by it when I read it. And I have pictures that this man would have been wonderful, he would have been very happy to have, because he shows only a couple of pictures in here. He shows a picture of Meyer Berman, who was the British chaplain, and Jake Hockman, who was the Jewish chaplain, the American chaplain, sitting with Zolli. That's about the only picture there is. And I have, he talks about the big ceremony that was held following that news that he had converted. The community was a little shattered. So we got together all of the American Army chaplains in Italy to come down to Rome on Friday afternoon. And the South African chaplain was there. His name was Potashnik, Pia Potashnik. And Meyer Berman, who was the British chaplain, and some people from the Jewish Brigade. At that time they were attached to the British Army. That was the Palestinian Jewish Brigade. It was the Jewish soldiers there from Palestine. We had a tremendous outpouring of the Jewish community of Rome. We got loudspeakers from the American Army. They cooperated beautifully. And I have pictures of that ceremony, and I'll show it to you.
What did they say? Just how were their feelings?
They were upset. They felt they were left behind. They were deserted. Although they had no respect for him. This was a common...
Even so.
Yeah. They had no respect for him.
How did he become chief rabbi? Was it a political...
Well, he was born in Poland, mm-hmm. and later came to Austria, and he came from Austria to Trieste. Mm-hmm. Trieste was the other side of... It was Treviso in Austria and Trieste in Italy, straight across the border. Mm-hmm. And he came to Trieste as the vice rabbiner. As a matter of fact, his name was Zoller, Zoller. And you'll ask me how I know that, and I'll tell you. Just before the 1st Division, 1st Armored Division, left to go back to the States, they were in Trieste, and it was Rosh Hashanah. And I was sent from Rome to go to Trieste to conduct the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services in the Trieste shul. And I sat in a chair that had a nameplate on it that said, Vice Rabbiner, that's Italian for Vice Rabbi, Israel Zoller, Zoller. And when he was called to, and when he became the chief rabbi in Trieste, he changed the name to Zoli, because that's in Italian. Italian would be the I, you know, you have to end with a vowel. Most places, most Italian names end that way. Then when he was there for a number of years, I don't remember, and then he was after Mussolini let Rabbi Prato leave.
We're not allowed to turn it off.
Turn it off, come on.
Oh, well, we'll say for... The Germans never found it. Go on. You're being recorded now.
So that was the Sefer Torah in Trieste?
The Sefer Torah in Trieste, yes. They hollowed out the stairwell. And under the stairs, walking up to the main synagogue, they took that all out. They put the Sefer Torah in there. And then sealed it up and painted it. Now, they had to leave out a couple of Sifrei Torah because the Germans knew that you had to use it in your service. Mm-hmm. And the Magna Carta was saved. The original Magna Carta was saved. They gave it to a priest who retained it and gave it back to them after the war. Mm. But it was a very, it was an interesting experience up there. But I was there, and then I went to, I was in Venice. Venice is rich in Jewish.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's mm-hmm. tremendous.
Well, didn't Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice come from Venice?
Well, yeah,
that's
true. I mean, I don't want to go, this has, it's interesting,
one of
but
the
it's
things
not,
yeah. that you had the privilege and opportunity of going to Palestine, mm-hmm. right after the war?
Right after the war, the American Army allowed chaplains to go on what they called R&R, rest and recreation, and for further study. That was technically why they were going to go.
Was this in 45?
45. Mm-hmm. So, but enlisted men were not allowed to go. I was serving in part of the chaplain section assigned to a Protestant chaplain, I think mm-hmm. I told you. I said to Bill Estes, I says, chaplain, I want to go to Palestine. I'd like to go. And he used to say, oh, Don, I'd like, but we can't do it.